This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on the stop-and-frisk lawsuit known as Floyd v. City of New York.
5 million unconstitutional frisks later, the lawsuit is finally going to court. Hopefully, it will end this nightmare, particularly for young African Americans and Latinos.
Attorney Martin Garbus will join us to give us an update on the case of the Cuban Five.
More and more revelations about how the United States paid journalists who then wrote propaganda to try and convict, unfortunately successfully, the Cuban Five.
We'll talk with Attorney Flint Taylor from Chicago about the latest update in the long-running saga of the Chicago police torture cases.
Someday, somewhere, we'll be able to give you the news. Former Mayor Daley will actually show up at his deposition on what he knew and why he didn't do anything about police torture in Chicago. Today's not the day.
Obama has stepped up the U.S. military deployment within the French-led military offensive to force out Islamist rebels in Mali, Africa.
Most of us never even heard of Mali, but now the U.S. is building drone bases across Africa. What's up in that part of Africa?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, you're fast becoming our in-house media critic. Last week, you analyzed an op-ed about Bradley Manning and pointed out the flaws in the reasoning. What do you have for us this week?
I mean, the Times just stinks on the Iraq War. Just stinks. I'm reading the editorial today when we're recording this, which is the 10th anniversary on March 20th, and it's called 10 Years After. The ill-conceived Iraq War continues to affect American policy. It's a long editorial. It talks about how we were sold a bill of goods, etc. And then it goes on to say, yet none of the Bush administration's war architects have been called to account for their mistakes. And even now, many are invited to speak on policy issues as if they were not responsible for one of the worst strategic blunders in American foreign policy. The entire editorial mentions nothing about the Times' role in what they are calling other people to account for, one of the worst American strategic blunders in our foreign policy history. Yet we all know, as we talked about last week, as I wrote a number of articles on this week, the Times was deeply, deeply implicated in helping pave the way to war. Bill Keller wrote a piece about a one kiloton bomb exploding in Times Square and what it would mean. They had Judy Miller and others pump us all up about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction. And Bill Keller, as I said last week, was called by the well-known intellectual Tony Jute one of Bush's useful idiots. And yet the Times has the nerve to write an editorial on the 10th anniversary blaming others but not looking at themselves. What else can we expect next?
Well, we'll look forward to our next installment of Michael's criticism of the New York Times.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've been covering the stop-and-frisk case known as Floyd v. City of New York and the New York Police Department. This is a federal class action lawsuit challenging New York City Police Department's practice of stopping and frisking hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers each year, some 5 million within the last few years. The high majority of the stop-and-frisks are against Latino and African Americans. It's taken the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with its allies, a group called Communities United for Police Reform, many years to bring this case to trial. It's an historic moment for challenging these practices in New York, and a precedent that will hopefully lead to ending this practice not only here in New York, but throughout the country. The trial began last week in federal court in Manhattan. It will last some 4 to 6 weeks. Today we get an update from CCR spokeswoman and director of their education program, Annette Dickerson.
Annette Dickerson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, we've followed the Floyd v. City of New York case, the stop and frisk case, as we call it, and understand that lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights were in court last week. Can you tell us what happened and what's the issue?
The issue is the illegality and the unconstitutional nature of the NYPD's stop and frisk program. They are, you know, in order to be legal, the stops need to be based on a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, and we are challenging the city's use of these illegal stops. They violate the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection because they are racially discriminatory. 87% of those stopped are Black and Latino. And then they also violate the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Now, Annette, in the media, I know that Police Commissioner Ray Kelly has defended the program. I would say he's been a little defensive about it. Has that changed at all in light of the case now being in the courtroom?
Absolutely not. Not only has it not changed, but publicly, the commissioner has seemed to have dug in his heels even deeper, as has the mayor, in defending the program. There is no empirical data that says that stop and frisk has a role in reducing crime. And in fact, severely damages relationships between the police and the community, and instead subjects hundreds of thousands a year and over a period, nearly 5 million New Yorkers to these often humiliating and intrusive searches.
Annette, I want to have you talk a little bit about how historic what is going on here. We have a trial, actually, in this case that may take, you have to tell us how long, where it's going on, and who some of the first witnesses have been and what they've said.
You are absolutely right. This is an historic moment in the life of a long-standing struggle among members of the community and organizations like CCR for many, many years. Our first case against the police department was actually Daniels, which was filed in 1999 in the aftermath of the shooting of Amadou Diallo. That incident occurred at the hands of the Street Crimes Unit. And so the settlement arising out of Daniels led to the disbandment technically of the Street Crimes Unit, and a number of stipulations by which the NYPD was supposed to abide. However, the stops and frisks not only continued, but were expanded enormously. And so, when it became clear that the police department was not abiding by the terms of the settlement, we went back to the judge, and we then filed the Daniels case.
Annette, let me just ask you for a second. In the Daniels case, was an impartial person or an auditor appointed to monitor compliance?
No, and that is part of the problem, because part of our seeking of remedies in this case is the appointment of a court-appointed monitor, because we believe that that is the only way that the police department will have to be legally compelled to make some substantive changes in how they operate.
We're having a number of witnesses, we being the Center for Constitutional Rights, appearing, and I read somewhere that the first witness is it David Floyd?
Yes.
What did he say?
David Floyd was actually helping someone who had been locked out of their apartment. He had an extra set of keys. And as they were seeking to gain entry through the keys that he had, the police ran up on them and stopped them and subjected him. Frankly, what he had been subjected to several times before, and which actually has become very much a regular part of certain people's lives in this city. So those were the circumstances under which this particular stop and frisk occurred.
Annette, someone asked me, what happens when an officer or two conducts a stop and frisk? Do they come up and say, excuse me, we need to ask you a few questions, or show us the contents of your pockets? What did they do, say, with Floyd?
Absolutely not. They are extremely aggressive. They are verbally abusive. In his case, touched him and went through his pockets. And this is very, very representative of what the average encounter is with the police. Another one of our plaintiffs indicated that, you know, they took his sneakers off and they went through his pockets and they, you know, they humiliated him and he was reduced to tears.
And this happens on a public street, so other people are watching, right?
Absolutely.
About how many people are stopped and frisked in New York on a yearly basis? Is there a racial divide on it? And if people want to see the trial, how do they do that?
The numbers on stop and frisk in 2011, 685,000 people were stopped, 87% of which were Black and Latino. And I'd like to take the opportunity to add now that even though the Floyd case is focusing on the, you know, the illegality and the racially discriminatory aspect of the stops and frisks, there are many other communities, including members of the LGBT community, the immigrant community, people who are homeless, women. These are all people who are being subjected to these stops and frisks and in many instances, you know, being touched inappropriately, spoken to in a very dehumanizing and humiliating way. And I just really wanted to make that point that this is a broad-based problem. Now, for 2012, the numbers seemed to have gone down slightly. However, we are still talking about more than 500,000 people that are being stopped. And one of the stated goals of Stop and Frisk is to get guns off the street. Well, the yield of guns is a fraction of 1%. And so if that is one of the goals of the program, I would say that it's a spectacular failure.
Annette, are most of the people stopped and frisked young persons?
Yes, the age span, the average age span is between 18 and 24.
And what a devastating effect that does have on young people in communities that are targeted. It's unfortunate that a lot of people now expect it, and I think that's a really dire statement of where we are.
Well, you know, there's a presumption of criminality, and when that is hanging over a community, and the impact of it extends to their parents, and the fear and the concern that they have, when you listen to these narratives, people are coming home from the store, kids are coming home from school, someone was on their way to their grandmother's house, living their everyday lives. And again, many of these young people are being subjected to it over and over and over again. So the fact that some of these kids know to assume the position and come to expect to be treated in this way has led to the understandable anger and frustration in communities of color in particular.
Now, listeners should know, Annette, that the Center for Constitutional Rights is also working in coalition with several organizations such as the Urban Justice Center, the New York Civil Liberties Union, Make the Road New York. Is this to increase awareness of these discriminatory policing practices?
CCR is a member of a citywide coalition called Communities United for Police Reform. And it is made up of over 60 organizations. Those of you who have been in New York for many years know that the struggle for police reform didn't actually begin in the courtroom, but began in communities of color who have for literally generations been besieged by various tactics by the police, of which stop and frisk is only the most recent iteration. And so Communities United for Police Reform has been engaged in community organizing, in Know Your Rights trainings. Some of the organizations work on cop watch programs. You know, they've been an enormously powerful force. On the first day of the trial, the courtroom was packed, as was the overflow room, so much so that the court had to set up a second overflow room to accommodate the hundreds of people who came down to the courthouse to see for themselves this historic day when the NYPD went on trial. And I have to say that a lot of that outreach is due to the hard work that has been done by Communities United for Police Reform.
Annette, I really want to thank you. I know the trial is going to last probably 4 to 6 weeks, maybe more. Can you just tell us where listeners can go to for two things? One, if they want to go to the trial, and secondly, a website if they want to find out more about the trial.
Yes. The website, we are actually providing daily updates on what is happening in the trial, and people can go to ccrjustice.org/Floyd. And on that page, you will also be able to see that the trial is occurring at the federal courthouse at 500 Pearl Street in courtroom 15C. We hope that the overflow rooms will continue to be provided, because we are really, really urging New Yorkers to come out and support this trial. Again, it's take about 4 to 6 weeks. There are going to be, you know, recordings of you know, that whistleblowers have recorded of the police pushing them to meet these quotas and get these numbers, and so, you know, there will be expert testimony by Jeff Fagan about the data that the police have provided us and the impact that it has, and the breakdown of different categories of how people are stopped. And we will also be able to provide information on the dates on which there will be no court due to holidays and other scheduling issues.
Annette, it's a pleasure to have you give this update, and we hope to talk to you in the future about what we hope will be a positive result from this litigation.
I hope so, too, and I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, you, Annette.
Take care. Years ago, five Cuban patriots, known as the Cuban Five, were convicted in the United States on charges of conspiracy to commit espionage. When First Amendment attorney Martin Garbus joined the case of the Cuban Five, he helped expose how U.S. government paid journalists in Miami receive thousands of dollars in payments from the Office of Cuba Broadcasting, a fact unknown to the defense at the time of the trial. As listeners may know, those paid reporters covered the case in hyperbolic and prejudicial fashion. Attorney Martin Garbus and many others will be discussing the case of the Cuban Five during an event held at Columbia University on March 29th. Martin Garbus, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, last time we had you on, we talked about the paid reporters in Miami who wrote in rather hyperbolic and slanted fashion about the case of the Cuban Five during the trial. Has there been an update on that?
Yes. Since then, we've come up with a great deal more information. The information that I gave you then and was in the papers then had to do with paid journalists basically working for the Miami Herald and other print media. Since then, we've come up with the fact that a lot of the paid journalists were also on the staffs of the various television stations, whether it be the local CBS or the Spanish American station and others. And what we have learned is that during the time that the jury was deliberating for that particular period of time, the television media bombarded the Miami area with pictures of the jurors. The judge had prohibited any pictures from the jurors going out because she didn't want the jurors to be intimidated by a public awareness of who they were, so that, because she was concerned that pressure would be put on them to come back with a conviction. So she was very clear throughout the entire trial that you couldn't print their pictures anywhere, you couldn't give out their names. At the time the jury deliberations started, unknown to the judge, and nobody paid attention to it, defense lawyers or anybody else, the channels each day repeatedly showed the faces of the jurors, sometimes identifying them, so that the entire community knew who they were. And they presented, of course, very, very slanted interpretations of the case, making it very clear that if the jurors were to vote for acquittal, they would be voting basically for Castro, for communism, socialism. As you know, at that time, the Cold War was still being fought in the Straits of Florida as it is today. So what we came up with is a cascade of television misuse. We found it not only for the time that the jurors were deliberating, but we've now traced it throughout the entire trial. So for the 8 months of the trial, including the deliberations, you had the local television media, national and local, bombarding the Miami area with pictures of the jurors, information about the jurors. We learned that the media, the paid media, followed the jurors to their cars, took down their license plates. We don't know what then happened. We're now talking about years ago, but we have found a totally different front in the case, and we submitted those papers a while after you and I last spoke.
And what are the chances that there would be, say, a rehearing, an appeal on this basis?
Well, where we are now is we submitted our papers, and the judge is sitting on it. Under the federal law, we have a certain period of time that we can go to the judge and say, Judge, you have to make a decision now. It's clear to me that if this case were anywhere other than Miami, and if it were anything other than Cuban involvement, that the case would be reversed in a second. The amount of money that the government poured in relentlessly prior to the arrest of these people, I mean, it was the shoot down is February 1996, the arrest is September 1998, and they're not charged with murder. The murder charges come in later. So it's more than 4.5 years after the shoot down that any of these defendants get charged with anything, and close to 3 years before anybody gets charged with the murder. And that's because of the incessant pressure put by the government on the media. At that time, you also had Alain Gonzalez, so there was a great deal of feeling that the right-wing community, Cuban community, had not been satisfied. And of course, we're talking about the time approaching the 2000 election, when the Cuban vote was of extraordinary importance, and both Democrats and Republicans were trying to persuade the Cuban right wing that those administrations were sensitive to it. Prosecution starts under Clinton and finishes under Bush. So you have an extraordinary situation. I've never seen anything like it.
Now, Martin, doesn't the government paying journalists rise to the level of violating anti-propaganda laws in this country?
It does. You're not allowed to... Now, Radio Marti, let's say, is originally created to beam into Havana. And Radio Marti, as it beams into Havana, can say most anything it wants. What happened here is Radio Marti beamed into the entire Miami area. And so you have the Radio Marti, you have a $38 million budget each year beaming into Miami, endless, endless stories. And then you have the American government through Radio Marti and various democracy projects also paying large sums of money to the print media to write propaganda. And you're exactly correct. It violates the law, the Smith-Mundt law. You're not permitted to do that. Each one of these articles are a violation of the law. But in a way, it's even worse than the Smith-Mundt law, at least if it comes from Radio Marti. The viewer, whether it be on TV, radio TV, or Radio Marti itself, the viewer at least knows that that's a government enterprise. What happened here was they were getting government propaganda through people who were not identified publicly with the government, people who were allegedly independent voices. So it's kind of the Smith-Mundt Act violations doubled and tripled in their severity. And what happens is that the Radio Marti information became the basis for the stories that these other people used. So there was a constant feedback from the Radio Marti information, which was really vituperative, off the charts, which is then repeated by journalists who were getting paid by the government to do exactly what Radio Marti was getting paid to do. So you're right. It's the most horrific violation I have seen of those statutes. And as I said, it's inconceivable that, given what we have now done, the jury intimidation, both before the deliberations but during the deliberations, was extraordinary. It violates the judge's gag order, never brought to the judge's attention. She didn't know about it. She now knows about it. The question is, she has a commitment to the conviction, and whether that conviction outweighs whatever we can bring before her is hard to evaluate.
We're speaking with Martin Garbus. Marty is the attorney for the Cuban Five, and we've been again talking about that important and remarkable case. And Marty, can you bring us up to date on a forum that you're going to be holding at Columbia University on March 29th? What's that about? Who's going to be speaking? And how can people get information?
On March 29th, at the Roon Arledge Auditorium, 116th Street and Broadway, the Cuban ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Reyes, and the Venezuelan deputy ambassador to the United Nations will be talking, Ambassador Escalona, as well as Luis Rosa of the Puerto Rican Independence Group, Imani Brown from the Columbia University Caribbean Students Association. I'll be speaking as well. There'll be live music. Michael Warren and some other people, he was a civil rights attorney who was involved in the Central Park Five case, as well as Nancy Cabrera, who's president of Casa de las Americas. So, and it starts, I think, at 7 o'clock.
And it's March 29th at 7 o'clock.
March 29th at Columbia University. And we hope to have a good turnout. And we hope to continue to get attention to the case so that it doesn't get shuffled as it's been shuffled for so many years.
Martin, thank you so much. And
thank
we appreciate your work on behalf of the Five.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Continue to follow up on the Chicago torture cases since the conviction and sentencing of former Chicago Police Commander John Burge in 2011. The Chicago criminal courts have become the venue for the seeking of justice for the crimes of torture and coerced confessions against some 120 black men. Last year, in our discussion with Chicago attorney Flint Taylor, we speculated on how the new administration under Rahm Emanuel would handle the ongoing torture cases. The question was readdressed by Flint in a recent article published in The Nation titled Racism, Torture, and Impunity in Chicago. In the article, Flint writes, Chicago City Council and Mayor Rahm Emanuel signed off on a settlement for another torture survivor, Michael Tillman, who was exonerated in 2010. It was the perfect chance for the mayor to apologize on behalf of the city to the African-American community that helped elect him. He chose not to do so. Instead, picking up where outgoing Mayor Daley left off, Emanuel has continued to fund Burge's defense, paying private lawyers a total of $3.8 million to date to do so in two cases. Attorney Flint Taylor and his People's Law Office has fought for 20 years against the wrongful conviction and to expose the complicity of Mayor Daley in the torture that resulted in false confessions. Flint Taylor joins us today. Welcome, Flint, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Well, you're definitely one of our most frequent guests on the show because we've been covering the long-running saga of the Chicago police torture cases. What's the latest wrinkle?
Well, there are several wrinkles, as it were, one of which is that in the civil rights cases, we are again seeking the testimony of Richard Daley, the former mayor and former state's attorney, to question him in detail about his long-standing and central role in the police torture scandal here in Chicago.
Would you elaborate on that? I mean, this is just an extraordinary scandal. Here you have the former mayor of Chicago, who was the chief prosecutor before he became mayor, and you're saying that he was involved in the torture of prisoners to elicit confessions from them and falsely put them in prison. This should be on 20-page type in the New York Times. What are you saying, and can you prove that Daley had something to do with the torturing of all these black men on the south side of Chicago?
Well, what we can prove is this. Back in 1982, when he was the elected prosecutor or Cook County State's attorney, that the torture scandal and the torture ring under John Burge was in full force. And evidence was brought directly to Daley through the police superintendent, the Chicago police superintendent, of torture of a specific man, Andrew Wilson, by the use of electric shock, baggings, beating, and burning to get a confession, that it was put directly on Daley's plate. And at that time, Daley decided not to investigate John Burge, not to prosecute John Burge. And as a result of that, over 75 more African-American men were tortured, gave confessions. Many of them went to death row. And the Daley's prosecutors not only used those confessions, but in at least 12 cases, Daley himself approved the death penalty for men who had been tortured by Burge with the either the knowledge of or participation of his state's attorney.
Flint, that's astonishing. But can you explain to our listeners what the import of having him testify would be? What will this mean if he gives his testimony?
Well, it would be the first time in over 30 years that he would be cross-examined. I would have the honor or privilege of doing so. And he would be put through the paces of all of this evidence and have to answer for the first time.
But could he be held liable?
He was joined in one civil rights lawsuit that we recently brought and made a defendant. The city settled that case before we could depose him in that case. This is the Ronald Kitchen case, he is not a defendant. The judge, I think wrongly, decided that he shouldn't be a defendant in this case, but he can't be held liable in this case for what his testimony shows and the evidence that I mentioned. But he certainly, in the court of public opinion here, people want to hear what he has to say. People don't believe that he has any deniability, and he is quite rightly seen as why John Burge was able to avoid prison for 30 years, and then when he did go to prison, he could only go to prison for perjury and obstruction of justice rather than for the torture itself, because Daley did not prosecute when the statute of limitations hadn't run back in the 80s.
So what's the status of getting Daley to give sworn testimony? I know you had a court order at one point.
Well, in this case, we have tried to negotiate with his lawyers. They are private lawyers who are paid by the taxpayer, like Burge's lawyers. And they, to put it indelicately, screwed us around for months and then finally said, no, we're not going to produce him. So we moved in court to compel him to testify. Daley recently filed an opposition to that in which he raised the specter of it being public, it being a videotape, it being put on YouTube, and said, well, I don't really have anything relevant to this case to say. So now the judge will have to decide in this case whether to compel him to testify or to give him a pass.
Flint, tell us, if you will, what the kind of local media coverage is about this. Is it getting the kind of attention you'd hope for?
Well, over the years, we fought very hard to bring this into the public, to public attention. It took a very long time, a very hard struggle by community groups, lawyers, and activists, and, of course, the families and the victims themselves. But it has reached somewhat of a critical mass here, so that the media is interested. They're certainly interested whenever the name Daley comes up. They want to see exactly what's going to happen with him. what is really still kept quite quiet in the straight media is the fact that this is such a overtly and powerful racial conspiracy.
I wanted to ask you about that, Flint, because you had that wonderful article 2 weeks ago in The Nation during Black History Month about the racist aspects of this conspiracy. Can you talk to us about that?
Certainly. Not only the overview is that this was 120 African-American men who were tortured by predominantly, if not almost exclusively, white detectives and supervisors, sergeants, and a lieutenant, of course, who was Burge. That's the first part of it. The second part of it is the nature of the brutality is also harkens one back to days of slavery, days of lynchings and Jim Crow. And then you look at the actual what these detectives were saying to these men while they were torturing them. And I hesitate to use the word, but I will, because they did. They called the electric shock box that they tortured people with the, quote, nigger, end quote, box. And that term was used again and again in various contexts. Another time when they brought out the plastic bag to suffocate someone to get him to confess, putting the bag over his head, they said to him, "We have something special for," again, quote, "niggers," end quote. That shows up again and again. We see the attacks on the genitals again and again, and of course that harkens back to the whole idea of slavery and lynchings for rape and all of that. We're using the Civil Rights Act that was enacted during Reconstruction, right after the Civil War, which is called the Anti-Ku Klux Klan Act, and it's very appropriate because what's being done here is the kind of racism and the kind of brutality that goes all the way back in history.
Flint, I want to let our listeners know that I was looking at the People's Law Office in Chicago's website a few days ago. The cases that you've taken on over the years are truly documenting racist history from COINTELPRO, Fred Hampton, to looking at modern-day spying of activists. And it just makes me really proud to know you.
Well, thank you. You know, it's a wonderful group of people I work with here. Some old-timers such as myself and younger lawyers, law students, and legal workers and interns. It's just been a wonderful place to work, and the attitudes that we share and the beliefs that we share really make this work meaningful to us and hopefully to the people that we represent.
What's the next step in your pursuit? Tell us, what you're going to do next?
Well, in terms of the daily situation, I'm working on a reply brief right now so that the judge can rule. We're proceeding full speed ahead in several torture cases, both in the civil court, but also trying to free some men who are still behind bars based on torture confessions. We're also in the political sphere trying to get reparations for men who have no civil rights claims but who were tortured. And we're trying to get a federal statute passed in Congress that will make torture by law enforcement a federal crime.
We wish you the best of luck. We know we'll be talking to you again, Flint, so we'll say goodbye for now, but not forever.
Good luck, Flint. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
You're very welcome anytime, and thank you for having such a great show.
Okay.
Bye-bye, Flint.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Obama administration has recently stepped up U.S. military deployment within the French-led military offensive in Mali, Africa. The U.S. Reaper drones are helping to provide targeting information for French aerial attacks. Those countries publicly supporting France include Canada, Belgium, Denmark, and Germany. Meanwhile, human rights groups call for independent investigations into civilian deaths in Mali. Today we talk with Ernie Harsh, a 40-year-long journalist who has made numerous trips to Africa. He's a former editor of the magazine Africa Renewal. He joins us today to discuss the conflicts in Mali and the big picture regarding the seizure of natural resources in Africa. Ernie Harsh, welcome to Law and Disorder. Ernie, the United States has recently stepped up its military presence in Africa, particularly in Mali. Can you tell us what's at stake there?
The stakes are not so much Mali, but at the regional level. The focus right now, of course, since the French military intervention in January, is Mali, and that's where a lot of the active fighting is. But as we've also seen, there's been blowback with the hostage taking in Algeria, blowback-type events to happen elsewhere as well. And, of course, for some of the actors, some of the insurgent forces, some have local grievances, like the Tuareg in northern Mali. Others are more consider themselves jihadists. And, of course, they also target U.S., French, other European interests in the region and elsewhere in the world. Whatever happens in Mali can have wider implications. And I just want to say the situation is quite serious in Mali and in the region. There's lots of risks. There's risk for the people of Mali, of West Africa, and as I noted, for others who are becoming drawn into this conflict, not necessarily reluctantly. Some have their own agendas at play.
Let me stop you for a second, Ernie.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out, why did the French go into Mali at all? I mean, people, we have to assume, like, I know almost zero. I barely heard of Mali as a country. And so what were the French doing in there?
Well, Mali is a former French colony. And after decolonization, the French in particular were especially active in intervening in their former colonies in Africa. We saw last year or the year before, they went heavily into Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, to support one of the sides in the war there. And they got a more friendly government in place, although that government was more internationally recognized than its rival. In Mali, you know, they consider it part of their general sphere of influence. The official rhetoric in France is that they're pulling back from that, from the old concept of what's called France-Afrique. But in reality, they still move in whenever they think something of immediate interest is at stake there. So maybe to understand that, we should talk about the situation in Mali itself.
Yes, that I think would be helpful because, you know, I don't know much, but I lead. I say, oh, it's uranium. France is 75% dependent on nuclear energy. I'm simpleton about this. But, yeah, I think you should. I think it would be really interesting.
Okay. I'll get to the uranium, which is actually in neighboring Niger actively. But in Mali, it was a French colony. For a couple of decades, you had a dictatorship very close to France. This was the era of the Cold War, also friendly to the U.S. There was a popular upsurge in the early 90s. That regime was ousted by a military coup. That leader of the coup quickly set up a transition to an elected civilian government. So since the early 90s, you've had a succession of civilian regimes. The problem, though, like in much of Africa, is that these states, whether they're elected or not, are extremely weak. Their political elites often are corrupt. Democracy doesn't go to the ground very far. So they lack credibility. In Mali in particular, you also had a series of rebellions in the north by an ethnic group called the Tuareg. I think there are four or five different rebellions since independence. Ceasefire agreements, you'd have peace agreements. Some of the Tuareg leaders would come into the regular army, but the basic issues never really got resolved. You didn't have development up in the north. You didn't have real autonomy, which is what they were pressing for. So then step back. What changed in 2011? We're going back to the wider region. We had the Arab Spring, Tunisia and Egypt. And like many periods of revolution or popular upsurge, old coercive states may collapse. And you have opportunities for popular action, but you also have other people who come in because states are fragmented. So in Libya in particular, this is where it relates to Mali, you had the NATO campaign against Gaddafi. That regime was overthrown. And some of the fighters who had been with Gaddafi had been from Mali, and they had been Tuareg among the Africa brigades that Gaddafi had set up. So with his ouster, a bunch of them went back to both Mali and Niger, and they set up some new rebel groups. So last year they made some rapid advances in northern Mali. North is very sparsely populated. It's a huge area, bigger than France, but not too many people except the Tuaregs and a few other ethnic groups. So the rebel advances in the north set off a lot of anger in the south, especially as the regular Malian army, which was very weak, suffered defeat after defeat. That stirred anger against the existing government, who had been elected, and it led to a mutiny, which transitioned into a coup in March of last year. That coup, unfortunately, didn't lead to a strengthening of the state, but just provided more opportunities for the insurgents to take more territory. In the meantime, the main Tuareg rebel group was sidelined by more explicitly Islamist forces, some of them linked to Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is largely Algerian in leadership. The leadership came out of the Algerian Civil War of the 1990s. They then instituted a very severe, harsh regime in the north. They imposed Sharia. Probably saw news reports, they did amputations, they did stonings for adultery, they destroyed the shrines for Islamic historical figures, and just generally oppressed the population of the north. So that was not a popular insurgency by any means, the Islamist groups. And it was at that point, where it looked like the regime was in especially bad shape, that the French intervened. Quickly turned around the situation. They pushed those forces further north, up into the mountains on the border with Algeria. Now it's sort of bogging down into a more protracted guerrilla phase. And that's where things can really get kind of difficult over the longer term, for the French in particular, and the U.S. has been providing them with logistical support. There are a few U.S. troops in Bamako, in the capital of Mali, but they're mainly around the U.S. embassy. But the main U.S. involvement is supporting the French intervention with logistics. They're working on refueling French planes in the air and that sort of stuff.
With respect to international law, what rights do the French have to be in there?
Well, last year there were several U.N. Security Council meetings that authorized the sending of an African peacekeeping force into Mali. There was no explicit mention of the French. There was no explicit authorization for a French intervention. The UN Security Council may agree to get more active on the African force idea, and perhaps they might acknowledge the French intervention. We don't know yet. That hasn't happened. But to be clear, the French intervention has gotten political backing from the African Union and from the West African Regional Group, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. While it might not be legal in international law, and I'm not an expert on this, generally it's been supported politically by countries that might otherwise criticize French military interventions and have criticized them elsewhere in the world. The French PR justification, I think, has worked fairly well. The atrocities by the Islamist forces played into their hands, made it look like a rescue mission, although it's far more complex than that, that's for sure.
Has the French intervention had measurable successes that you can talk about?
Militarily, yes, because this is open terrain. This is semi-desert and desert area. With air power, with heavy equipment, you can push far very quickly. You can take cities and towns. And the Islamists, who just are a few thousand, to be frank, there's not a lot of them. Some have been killed in any battles they choose to engage in. They've pulled back up into the mountains. They know the terrain very well, is better than the French, certainly. So the chance of French losses mounting is there. There are about 3,000 or so African troops from different African countries that are also there. And they've been suffering some losses as well, especially the Chadians, who are the one West African army that actually knows how to do desert warfare. Others are from the forested coastal areas. So it's kind of unknown terrain for them. Probably also see blowback operations as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb take hostages from various Western nations.
There was a lot of news a few months ago about the United States' increased interest in Africa and stepped up military presence in Africa. And how does what's going on in Mali and Niger fit in with that?
Well, the U.S. has focused, especially since 9/11, and with the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, on what they see as a new front in the war on terror. It was kind of low-key initially, looking at West Africa and around the Sahara. But since 2005, the U.S. has spent more than $1 billion so far for counter-terror operations in the region. Now, this isn't all military by any means. A lot of it has to do with training local African military forces in counterterrorism operations and coordinate and logistics support, also in basically propaganda. They do humanitarian actions to try to curry favor with local populations. They do some medical, you know, assistance to local populations. Money isn't for military or intelligence, but a good chunk of it is. This isn't very well known, but the U.S. now has about a dozen air bases across Africa. That's not U.S.-only air bases. Sometimes they're simply a hangar operated in secret at some African military or civilian air base, from which they use for spy flights. They use small aircraft. They're now setting up a base in Niger. That's openly acknowledged. 100 U.S. troops are going there to set up a drone base.
They say it's a surveillance drone base, right? Not a
surveillance, yes.
Not a killer drone base.
They're not armed at this point.
Right.
They could easily be re-outfitted if things change. They started off with surveillance drones in Somalia, but then they used a few strikes against Islamist leaders there as well in Somalia.
Should we care at all about the French and the U.S. intervention in Mali? Should we care about all these little drone bases? I mean, is this about, what's it about? Is it about resources, keeping China out? Is it about jihadists? What is it?
Well, everything is going to be framed as in the language of the war on terror. That's the justification. Not to say that that's a fiction or a myth. I mean, that's a very real concern for the U.S. authorities. Insurgents, whatever their ideology, it could be something else, who are hostile to U.S., French, Western interests in the region. Also, material resource interests. So much in Mali itself. Mali does have some gold, but that's mainly gold mining. It's mainly in the south and west, not in a part of the region that was occupied by the insurgents. There is major uranium mining in neighboring Niger. That's the fourth largest producer of uranium in the world, and that's a French company in particular that's running those. Special forces guarding those two Areva French company mines in Niger. So they're worried, obviously, about any spillover. The government there is fairly weak. You have Tuareg rebels there as well. So they don't know how that will go. You have gold mining picking up in Burkina Faso, which is just south of Mali, natural gas in Algeria and Libya. You know, so the whole Saharan region is rich in resources. And keep in mind, there's Africa as a whole, where African oil is becoming increasingly important to U.S., in particular, to the rest of the West. There's a mining boom across the continent where heavy, heavy Western investments are going into mining, be it gold, other minerals, even iron ore. Things that are very vital to the global economy, the Western-dominated global economy.
What role is China have in all this? I mean, are we going in there partly to keep resources, not just for ourselves, but to keep them away from China?
Well, there is a rivalry that's developed with China. It's not been terribly direct at the moment. The Chinese have been very astute in arranging deals with some African governments to get in there. They do barter arrangements where they do Chinese investment in exchange for resources. In Angola, it's for oil. They're involved in mining operations in Sudan. I'm not aware of anything in Mali as such, although they do have some commercial operations in West Africa. Sometimes it's sort of construction kinds of infrastructure deals. Chinese are more interested or more apt to invest in that than Western companies are. Infrastructure is really lacking. So building roads, bridges, and so on, it's not something that attracts Western investors, but the Chinese do go in.
And I have a question about Libya. You mentioned that there were fighters that were working on behalf of Gaddafi against the U.S., and those were Tuareg, I guess that's the way you pronounce it, or something like that, who then went back into Mali. But I also read somewhere that the U.S., to overthrow Gaddafi, or the French, had armed some jihadists as well, or somebody to oppose Gaddafi, and those people went back and now were also involved in trying to overthrow the government of Mali. Was there anything to that?
Well, it's a very murky world, and there are some indications. The French did have some intelligence ties. I'm not so sure about the U.S. The Algerians definitely did, and the Algeria has been working covertly with the U.N. for a number of years now. So against Gaddafi, yes. There's some indications they were supporting some of these groups. But keep in mind, too, when the Libyan regime fell, a lot of the prisons just opened up. So you had imprisoned jihadists in Libya who also then were free. Some of them were from other countries, so they've gone back. Some are still active in Libya out. They're talking about restructuring the Malian army. The European Union is already sending in technicians to train, but that's mainly on technical and logistical stuff. We're likely to see more abuses by the Malian army. We've seen reports already of abuses against civilians, so that's a serious concern. And they have no real development agenda for northern Mali. More widely for the U.S., their concerns aren't being allayed. They're going to continue their war on terror. They think they've been a little slow on the upkeep so far. And unfortunately, you know, their vision is a very narrow one. It's a very security, intelligence, military kind of vision that doesn't take into account the interests of the people on the ground, which is, I mean, many of them are very, very poor, and they see few prospects. So the anger at their own governments, at outside powers that are supporting their governments, is likely to increase. I think the risks and the possibilities of other things, whether Mali is settled or not, are very high, and that we will see some more incidents like this, other wars. I don't want to sound alarmist. That may not be in the next 2-3 years. We don't know. But it's a very volatile region overall. And I doubt the U.S. is going to pull back on its basic interests for oil, other natural resources, or political domination, if you want to put it that way. I'd like to see governments that they could work with. They don't have to be pro-American, but at least some governments that they can work with. Very, very uncertain.
Ernie Harsh, thank you very much. This is an area that's unknown to most people, except you, and we're grateful to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Ernie.
Bye, Ernie. Thank you.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.